Hey there. Welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Andre Uzumtoma, and I'm a first-year law student here at Queen's Faculty of Law. Queen's Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aim to make legal discussions more accessible to you, the general public. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show explores the evolving landscape of Canadian drug laws, specifically as they relate to psychedelics, which are better known as magic mushrooms or simply shrooms. Before I start, I want to clarify that the views expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, hosts, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. PBSC is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC student volunteers like myself are not lawyers, so I'm not authorized to provide you, the listeners, with any legal advice. These episodes contain a general discussion of topical legal issues, so if you require specific psychedelic legal advice, get off this podcast and speak to a lawyer. Let's dive right into it. So, why this topic for this week's episode? Well, it all started with a conversation I had with a friend last fall. We were walking through downtown Toronto when we passed a shop openly selling magic mushrooms. Neither of us said anything and just kept walking though. A few blocks later, however, we turned a corner and came face to face with yet another magic mushroom storefront. My friend looked at me and said, "Wait, I didn't realize shrooms were legal." "I don't think they are," I replied. "Well, aren't you the law student?" he quipped. I had to concede. I actually wasn't sure. And that got me thinking. If I, as a law student, didn't fully understand what was going on with these stores, how many other Canadians were just as confused? How are magic mushroom shops openly operating across the country when psilocybin is presumably illegal? That's what I set out to uncover. And more importantly, that's what I want to share with you today. Let's start with a psychedelics 101 introduction. Psychedelics are known for their ability to shake up consciousness, altering perception, thoughts, and mood in ways that can be deeply transformative and profound for some. The classic psychedelics include LSD, mescaline, and psilocybin, which is the main psychoactive compound in magic mushrooms and the key player behind all the cultural buzz, controversy, and curiosity surrounding them. Then you've got the quote-unquote atypicals, things like MDMA and ketamine, which don't fit neatly into the classic category. Some of these substances, like psilocybin and mescaline, have been used for centuries in indigenous ceremonies for healing and spiritual exploration, whereas others, like LSD, are lab-made in the 20th century. Now here's where things get interesting. Psychedelics don't work like most drugs. While each one has its own effects on perception and emotions, the experience itself can vary widely from person to person. Trips can last minutes to hours, and for some, the after effects can linger for days, weeks, or even years. The exact science behind these experiences? Still kind of a mystery. One reason psychedelics are being explored for therapy and healing is their impact on neuroplasticity. Basically, they help the brain rewire itself, making it easier to break old thought patterns and form new ones. This can be especially important for people dealing with severe medical conditions, perhaps in tandem with the emotional weight of facing death. Psychedelics can potentially offer a way to ease suffering or reset the mind when nothing else seems to work. Now, are psychedelics safe? Well, compared to most other psychoactive substances, they're considered low risk and non-addictive, except for ketamine, which is a bit of an outlier. But let's be real, they're certainly not risk-free. A trip can turn into panic, anxiety, or reckless behavior, and in rare cases, long-term psychological effects like psychosis or visual disturbances can stick around. That's why most clinical trials exclude people with conditions like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or heart issues. It's simply just too risky. What's even less understood is how often these risks actually happen in real-world use. Lately, researchers and advocates have been pushing back against psychedelic hype, gathering reports of bad trips and negative experiences to make sure we're having a balanced conversation about their potential and their pitfalls as well. So, whether you're curious, cautious, or all in on the psychedelic renaissance, one thing's for sure. These substances are not only reshaping conversations around consciousness and therapy, but they're also challenging the legal frameworks that govern them. But where exactly does the law stand on psychedelics like psilocybin? Let's break that down next. The Controlled Drugs and Substances Act is the federal statute governing the legality of psychedelics in Canada. Under Section 4 of this act, it's illegal to possess a substance listed in Schedules 1, 2, or 3, unless authorized by regulation. We'll get into that later, though. Psilocybin is classified as a Schedule 3 substance, meaning unauthorized possession is a criminal offense. Let's discuss criminal offenses, because they fall into two categories: summary conviction and indictable offenses. In simple terms, a summary conviction is for less serious crimes and usually comes with lower fines and shorter jail time. An indictable offense, however, is for more serious crimes, carrying heavier penalties and longer prison sentences. This distinction is important when looking at the differing legal consequences. For example, the punishment for a summary conviction for possession of psychedelics is a fine of up to $1,000 and or imprisonment for up to 6 months for a first offense. A repeat offense can lead to a fine of up to $2,000 and or imprisonment for up to 1 year. However, if charged as an indictable offense, possession of psychedelics carries a maximum penalty of up to 3 years in prison. Before I proceed with more sentencing ranges for the various offenses dealing with psychedelics, I just want to offer the disclaimer and clarify that all the following sentences and penalties discussed throughout this podcast are taken directly from the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act and the Criminal Code. And they don't necessarily represent all possible penalties or sentencing ranges. So, if you're facing charges under the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, please consult a lawyer. Okay, let's turn our focus to Section 5 of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, which prohibits the trafficking of psychedelics. Trafficking includes selling, giving, and transporting controlled substances. If convicted summarily, the maximum penalty for trafficking psychedelics is up to 18 months in prison. If prosecuted as an indictable offense, the sentence can be as high as 10 years. Similarly, Section 6 of the Act, which governs the import and export of psychedelics, and Section 7, which regulates their production and cultivation, also carry a potential 10-year prison sentence for those convicted under these provisions, Sections 6 and 7. Despite these strict laws and punishments, psychedelics dispensaries are opening across Canada at surprising rates. So, at this point, you might be wondering, if all these legal barriers exist, how are businesses like the ones we encountered still operating in broad daylight? Well, if this sounds familiar, it's because we've seen a similar story before with cannabis. Before cannabis was legalized in 2018, unlicensed cannabis dispensaries began appearing in major Canadian cities, openly selling products that were still technically illegal. Law enforcement responses varied, with some cities cracking down while others turned a blind eye, allowing the market to grow. The same fragmented approach is now unfolding with psilocybin dispensaries. In Vancouver, police have largely ignored them, while in cities like Toronto, there have been sporadic raids, including notable seizures in 2023. But in the past year, enforcement has softened, much like what happened with cannabis in its final years of prohibition. This has allowed the underground psychedelic market to expand rapidly. Many psilocybin dispensaries are modeled after early cannabis shops, offering everything from dried mushrooms to microdosing kits in sleek, consumer-friendly packaging. By operating openly, they're effectively challenging local authorities to shut them down. And for now, many law enforcement agencies seem hesitant to fully engage. The uncertainty around enforcement has sparked mixed reactions. Some advocates see these dispensaries as a way to normalize psychedelics and accelerate legalization. Others worry that their unregulated presence could backfire, making lawmakers more resistant to change. The disparity in enforcement might also be explained by what some call a form of psychedelic exceptionalism, which is the idea that authorities view psychedelics as relatively low risk compared to the ongoing crisis surrounding opioids and other more hard drugs. Psilocybin advocates argue that the path forward should mirror cannabis legalization. Before legalization, cannabis was first permitted for medical use, eventually leading to broader access. Advocates suggest a similar model for psilocybin, where patients could either grow their own, designate a caregiver to grow for them, or obtain it through regulated suppliers. This is where psychedelic litigation becomes critical. Courts have played a major role in shaping drug policy in Canada, particularly in medical cannabis cases. And now, a similar battle is unfolding for psilocybin. The constitutional right to individualized medical psilocybin access is currently being tested in the Canadian courts through the 2022 Hartle lawsuit. This case could determine whether patients have a fundamental right to access psilocybin for medical use, challenging the existing legal barriers that have made it nearly impossible to obtain. In July 2022, 8 plaintiffs, including patients and healthcare professionals, filed a lawsuit against the Ministry of Health challenging the prohibition of psilocybin. Psilocybin medical exemptions are technically allowed in Canada, but in practice, the plaintiffs in Hartle in Canada argue that the system is so restrictive and unreliable that it effectively denies them access. At the moment, there are two paths individuals can take to receive medical exemptions. First, doctors can apply through the Special Access Program, or SAP, to get psilocybin for patients with serious or life-threatening conditions. Or second, patients can apply for a Section 56 exemption under the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act to use psilocybin for medical purposes. It's worth noting that the Section 56 exception is also used to allow researchers and universities to legally study psychedelics. For example, the University of Toronto has been exempted to conduct clinical trials using psilocybin and analyze the drug's effect and potential for medical applications. The problem is that these two exceptions are unreliable and hard to obtain. Health Canada has stopped granting Section 56 exemptions for ongoing medical use, rejecting nearly all new applications since March 2021. Meanwhile, SAP approvals are highly restrictive, mainly used for emergency cases and involve high costs, often forcing patients to travel long distances to receive care. Thus, the plaintiffs in the Hartle lawsuit claim that patients face long delays, inconsistent approvals, and a lack of clarity on how to get approved. The Hartle lawsuit includes testimony from terminal cancer patients experiencing debilitating end-of-life distress, individuals with PTSD and anxiety disorders who have exhausted all other treatment options, and psychotherapists who need psilocybin training to provide effective treatment but are denied access. Thus, practitioners and patients alike are forced to suffer without treatment, or choose from treatment options that do not work and are only left with the option of medical assistance in dying, or, in the worst case, resort to illegally obtaining psilocybin because the legal system has failed them. Ultimately, practitioners and patients need more options, and medical psilocybin regulations like these ones used for cannabis might help give them that other option they're looking for. Having said all this, the plaintiffs in Hartle claim that Health Canada's refusal to grant reliable access to psilocybin violates Section 7 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which guarantees the right to life, liberty, and security of the person. Let's unpack this alleged Section 7 violation. Denying access restricts one's right to life, liberty, and security by causing unnecessary suffering and, in some case, worsening mental health. The current system puts health decisions in the hands of the government instead of the doctors, inherently forcing patients in an undue state-imposed burden. The bottom line is that Hartle is trying to get at is that medical exceptions for psilocybin exist on paper, but in reality, they're almost impossible to obtain. So, what's the end goal of the Hartle lawsuit? Well, the plaintiffs are asking for a court declaration that Canada's psilocybin laws are unconstitutional. They want permanent constitutional exemptions allowing patients to legally possess and grow psilocybin, and they want exemptions allowing health professionals to use psilocybin for training. Ultimately, they are hoping for a shift from the government as a gatekeeper to a system where doctors determine patient access, like with prescription drugs. But while much of the conversation around psychedelics focuses on their therapeutic potential, their use also raises significant questions in criminal law. Next, I want to discuss the 2022 case of the Crown and Brown, which highlights how psychedelic use intersects with criminal liability and how cases like this have influenced amendments to Canada's criminal code. In January 2018, Matthew Brown consumed alcohol and mushrooms at a party in Calgary. Experiencing a psychotic episode, he left the party, broke into a woman's home, and assaulted her, causing severe permanent injuries. Brown claimed he was in a state of extreme intoxication or automatism, arguing that he committed the crime without conscious awareness or voluntary intention. Brown challenged the constitutionality of Section 33.1 of the Criminal Code, which barred the defense of extreme self-induced intoxication leading to automatism. And he was successful in doing so. The Supreme Court ruled that Section 33.1 was unconstitutional because it automatically imposed criminal liability. However, the case also sparked public concern, particularly about the potential for people to take psychedelics, commit violence, and then claim a lack of intent to escape criminal liability. So, Parliament rewrote Section 33.1 to allow the defense only if the accused can prove they did not negligently act in consuming the intoxicant. So, what does the new Section 33.1 mean for current psychedelic cases? The law now takes a case-by-case approach when someone tries to use the extreme intoxication defense. Courts will ask, was it objectively foreseeable that taking a large dose of psychedelics could lead to a state where the person lost control? Did they take any steps to avoid that risk, like limiting their dose or staying in a safe environment? Were they aware that substances like psilocybin or LSD can trigger hallucinations, paranoia, or even violent outbursts? This new standard makes it much harder to claim extreme intoxication as a defense, even with psychedelics, which are generally considered non-violent drugs. Judges will look at key factors like how much the person took. Was it a controlled microdose or an overwhelming amount likely to cause psychosis? They'll also consider the person's individual tolerance and past experiences. For example, did they understand what they were getting into? And finally, was the intoxication truly extreme? We're talking about a complete loss of control and awareness, not just a bad trip. And this part further requires medical evidence and expert testimony. In short, simply saying, "I was too high to know what I was doing," won't cut it. The law now asks, should you have known better before taking the drug in the first place? Lastly, I want us to turn back to the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act and highlight Section 4.1, which I think is very important for listeners to know about. Section 4.1 of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act provides protection for individuals involved in a medical emergency caused by psychedelics. Legally, a medical emergency refers to a life-threatening event triggered by a psychedelic substance where emergency medical or law enforcement assistance is reasonably necessary. Section 4.1 holds that if someone seeks emergency assistance for themselves or another person during a medical emergency, they cannot be charged if the evidence supporting the charge was obtained because they sought help or remained at the scene. This protection applies to others present at the scene when emergency personnel arrive, including the person experiencing the medical emergency, of course. The law encourages individuals to seek life-saving assistance for themselves or others during emergencies. It removes the hesitancy in calling for help and the fear of prosecution, thereby prioritizing saving lives over criminal penalties. All right, we've come to the end of this episode, so let's bring it all together. Psychedelics, particularly psilocybin, are at a fascinating crossroads in Canada. On one hand, they're still illegal under the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, which we've spoken about at length, with harsh penalties for possession, trafficking, production, cultivation, and distribution. On the other hand, dispensaries are popping up across the country. Enforcement is inconsistent, and legal challenges like the Hartle case are pushing for change. If history tells us anything, it's that the law doesn't always keep pace with cultural and scientific shifts. We saw this with cannabis, where underground markets thrived and legal battles chipped away at prohibition until full legalization became inevitable. Psychedelics seem to be following a similar trajectory, but whether they'll reach the same outcome and how long it will take is still up in the air. So, what's the big takeaway? First, the legal landscape around psychedelics is evolving, but for now, psilocybin remains illegal unless you have a rare exemption. Second, the growing presence of mushroom dispensaries is testing the limit of law enforcement and public tolerance, much like early cannabis shops did. And finally, courts could play a major role in determining whether psilocybin becomes more accessible, especially for medical use. Whether you're fascinated by the science, interested in the policy debates, or just wondering why there's suddenly a shroom shop on every corner, one thing is clear. This is a legal conversation that's far from over. Thanks for tuning in.